Hey there, it's Frank Buckley. This time on the podcast, it's a woman who had me in tears during our conversation. Her story is that moving. And I wasn't the only one moved by Tembi Locke's real-life story. Zoe Saldana and Reese Witherspoon liked it so much, they're in the process of shooting a Netflix series based on it. In fact, Tembi Locke and a crew of filmmakers are in Florence, Italy, right now, shooting the series based on Tembi's book, From Scratch, A Memoir of Love, Sicily, and Finding Home. It's a book about the man she married, an Italian, a Sicilian chef. It's about the chef's mother and Sicilian family who didn't approve of their son marrying a black actress from America. It's about what happened when they adopted a girl and he got cancer. I can't wait to see the series, and I hope Tembi will join us again when it does. But for now, let's revisit that conversation with Tembi Locke from 2019. Tembi, welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm so excited to share your story with our listeners and our viewers. And that you capture so beautifully in your book, From Scratch, A Memoir of Love, Sicily, and Finding Home. I read the dedication to my wife, and, you know, she became emotional just hearing the dedication. So I want to share that with our viewers and listeners. For sorrow, who lit the fire of love, for our daughter, Zoella, the eternal flame. Who was sorrow? How did you meet?
Well, Sado was my husband, but before he was my husband, or while he was my husband, he was an Italian chef, and we met when I was a college student. I was in Florence studying art history, and I was 20 years old, and I'm literally walking down the street, and he rounded a corner. We bumped into each other, yeah. And that collision, that intersection, right, changed my life. I didn't know it at the time that it was going to change my life, but it did.
Because you actually sort of pushed him away initially.
Yeah, a little bit. I was like, yeah. I mean, he was nice and gentle and handsome and all the things, but there was like a country full of handsome, gentle, you know, gorgeous men. And he, you know, I thought it was a chance encounter. Plus, I was only there at that time for a semester. So the idea of a relationship or anything more than maybe just being friends. And so I kind of rebuffed it a little bit, but it became really clear pretty quickly that there was something magical.
And he was really into you.
Yeah.
He shows up one day and pulls you out of a bar and says, I have something for you. And what did he have sitting on the curb for you?
He had a bicycle. He had a red bicycle with a basket and a bell. And, you know, we had had a previous conversation in which I'd mentioned, wherein I mentioned that I'd been riding the bus around Florence. And, you know, it was between bus schedules and, like, the crowding and getting to class. It was just sort of cumbersome, right? And I mentioned it just in passing. But he grabbed it. He held on to the idea. And when I saw him again, he says, I want to show you something. And he bought it. And so for me, it was like, wait, what? Okay. And it was gorgeous. It was like, you know, and I'm a college student in Florence. So the idea of like bicycling through the streets of Florence, it captured my imagination. It told me who he was, what a good listener he was, how thoughtful he was, his willingness to sort of take initiative. You know, those are all the things. That's the making of like a good thing.
And it was a good thing.
Yeah.
How did it get to from there to being a good thing? I guess I'm asking you to fast forward because your book takes us through the whole romantic journey. But
Yes. Maybe
take us to the point that you decide that it's more than just a student fling.
Yeah. I'll tell you, it actually emerged over a series of events. But the one that I write about in the book, which I'll share, because even to this day it still takes my breath away when I think about it, is we had this arrangement. Right, where after he finished work chefing, he would come by the piazza to the apartment I rented with a bunch of other, you know, sort of Americans and co-eds and whatnot. And he couldn't ring the bell because it was late at night. And, you know, our den mother, you know, who sort of, you know, like we were subletting from, she didn't like everybody waking her up in the middle of the night with their like pesky boyfriends from, you know. So he would wait underneath a lamppost. And I would go look down at the window, and when I saw him, I would let him in. Well, one night I fell asleep. And I really fell deep into sleep. And when I woke up, it was raining. And I thought, oh my God, oh my gosh, no, no, oh no. And I ran to the window, and knowing, there's no way he's going to be there. And there he was.
Standing in the rain.
And the way I talk about it in the book, which I know now, you know, he was really making love an action. He was making love steadfast, consistent, willing to show up in the face of obstacles, which emerged later in our life, right?
Something you would do as well.
And thank you. And that I really learned from him, you know? But that moment that, you know, so we were sort of in this sort of the giddy and the love of, like, you know, Florence and Vespas and Chianti and, like, pasta and chefing and all of that, right? And I'm thinking, this is a wonderful way to spend a semester abroad. And then when he was standing in the rain, bumped it to another level.
And what level did it get to?
Well, I then was willing to say, you know, let's make this work any way we can. And of course, I had to finish schooling. I had to come back to the States to finish at Wesleyan. I was studying in Connecticut at the time. And he said, you know, look, people eat all over the world. I'll go where you go. Wait, what? You know, I was, and
that's
and
a lot for
it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. Yeah. And but his clarity of the vision for who we could be and the kind of relationship and love we could have, it was just unwavering. Mm-hmm. And so I really was inducted into that. You know, I thought, well, okay. And so we, you know, he sold his interest in the bar. He was also chef. He had owned a bar at the time with friends. He was chefing. I came to back to school, finished, and then we decided to start our life here in the States.
Yeah. Your acting career takes off pretty quickly.
Yeah, I was very blessed.
What was your first big role?
Yeah, well, my first big role was here in L.A. I was cast as a love interest to Will Smith on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. And so it was literally my first audition.
Wow.
Okay, Frank, we drove across country, right, with, like, you know, in the Toyota, everything packed in the back. And we got here, didn't really know anyone, checked into a Motel 6, because that's, we were like, oh, we got to find a place. Okay, that's off the freeway.
Wow.
And there are a lot of freeways in L.A. So we checked in, and then I got a call that I had an audition the next day. I go in, I audition, I book the job. So for me, it was sort of like, this is meant to be.
Yeah.
Like, this is just meant to be. And and it was a great, great sort of introduction to what would be a great career.
Yeah. At what point do you get married?
We got married about 2 years after we moved to L.A. So I was 25 at the time.
Yeah.
We'd been together about 5 years. And
and he was chefing here
in
L.A.?
He was chefing here. Yeah. He was sort of doing stages at different places and whatnot. And we were kind of just like, I remember, and you will appreciate this, when we moved here and we finally got an apartment, we were filling out applications. And I remember one prospective landlord or property manager said, so what do you guys do? And I said, well, I'm an actress and he's a chef. And she said, oh, great. Just what LA needs, another actress and another chef. And I remember thinking, okay, you're probably right. But we don't want this place. That's bad juju. You just got, like, negative energy.
Yeah,
like,
see you later.
No. Right. Yeah, we're going to do this. We got this.
And so you get married, and actually we shouldn't skim over that, because you at some point have to go to Sicily.
Yes.
To meet your husband-to-be's family. How does he prep you for that?
Well, that was a series of ongoing conversations. And, you know, I write about this time in our lives in the book, because Sato had sort of his moving from Sicily, having been raised there, then moved to Florence to be a chef. He'd really broken from his family in the sense of career choice and where he was living, and they really didn't sort of get it, you know? And so there was an estrangement, a fracture, if you will, right? Sort of, I know it's not too much to say, you know, the father's son, a sense of disappointment, right? So that,
and we should say in the Italian family, and I know a little bit about this because I'm married to a woman who comes from an well, she's Italian.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the family, is everything.
The family is everything.
In Italy.
And having left Sicily, having chosen a career that they didn't really understand, in a place that they weren't comfortable or felt familiar. So Sato and his family already sort of had this mostly with his dad, really. I think the father-son piece, which I think are complicated relationships often.
Yeah.
So when I came into his life, right, I was sort of like another way he was choosing to be different.
Mm-hmm.
I was yet something else that was other,
yes.
Right? American, black. I wanted to be an actress. You know, I had divorced parents, like things that for an Italian family, they were like, what? And so they really didn't sort of, they were very reticent initially. Mm. And in fact, more than reticence, it became kind of a standoff.
Mm.
Saying we can't really condone or accept this.
Mm.
Because if we do, you know, I think to their thinking and their town, right, small, rural, Sicilian town, we will be looked down upon when this goes south, which I think was sort of the idea. Like, I remember, you know, hearing from Sado, he's like, you know, my parents think all Americans divorce. Like, you know, they don't want to sort of sanction this union, right? So we were basically approaching our wedding with really not only without their blessing, but with their absence.
Mm.
You know, they had declared they were not coming, and we were getting married in Italy.
Mm.
So it was a challenging and painful time in the midst of a great joy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the things that I try to discuss in the book is that way in which I think Sato was, as he was creating our new family, he was also having to kind of distance himself from his own family.
Mm.
And that was, there was a lot of pain in that. So we did get married. We had a big, beautiful, fun wedding in Italy,
yeah,
without his family. And then about 2 years went by. 2 years, Frank, right?
Yeah.
And I... You know, as spouses do, when you know when someone you love is suffering a silent pain.
Mm.
And I knew that the distance that was between him and his, there was a silent pain there.
Yeah.
That sometimes we talk about, sometimes we wouldn't. And I said, we have to go. We're going to Sicily. And he had the look on his
yeah,
face that you have
right,
on yours. He was like, what, what? And I said, no, we're going to go. And I think we had a little, you know, if he were here, I think he would, you know, have his version of the conversation,
right.
But basically it was like, no. And I said, yeah, no, yeah. And I just went and bought tickets.
Mm. And did you reach out to?
Well, we let them know that we were going to be coming.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
And the message we got in return was, well, you don't need to come here.
Wow.
So that trip became kind of a singular moment of opening our hearts with the hopes of a big reconciliation.
Mm.
Because at that point, I knew it couldn't be about me, Tembi, because we'd never met.
Yeah.
Right?
It
was more about the idea,
yes,
of a son having made choices that perhaps his dad didn't agree with.
Right.
Right? And I just felt in my heart, we can overcome that. We can, I mean, that's the American eternal
right,
optimism.
Yes.
Like,
we're gonna
do it.
Yes.
You know, we'll just get in there.
Yeah.
You know, storm them. Like,
right,
you know,
right.
we'll convert them.
Yes,
you
right,
know, and I just was like, this is gonna happen. And we got there, and you know, it didn't happen right away. And I had to sit with that. You know, because I had to sit with the fact that we were halfway around the world, and you know,
they wouldn't receive you.
Yeah, in short, and so, but there was. What I didn't know and what I share in the book is that there were some behind the scenes working. So if we know anything about, and you know about Italian families, you know, they're very matriarchal.
Mm-hmm.
And when a matriarch decides she wants to see her son.
Yeah, then it happens.
She's going to see her son.
Right.
And so without giving too much away, that's a beautiful moment for all of us because it became the beginning of all of our lives opening up in this gorgeous way,
yeah,
right? And, you know, again, I didn't know it at the time. I just thought, well, I just met my in-laws. Great, you know? And I kind of went on about my life. But as you know, as you've read the book, within a few years, a big diagnosis happens. So that early reconciliation became really meaningful.
Yes.
Because they really had an opportunity to be in their son's life,
yeah,
at a critical time.
When you adopted Zoella,
yes,
how did they react to that?
loved it. Mm. I mean, one of the things about Italian families, children are children.
Love like, children.
Come on.
Right.
It's like a baby.
Right.
And I remember when we first took her there, she was like 6 months old. And my mother-in-law was like, first of all, the whole town came out to see her. And then my mother-in-law was like, you know, I grabbing her, hugging her, kissing, you know. And the next thing she says, has she had pasta yet? I'm like, she's 6 months old. Like, why would she have pasta?
Yeah.
But she had pasta.
Right.
Because they gave her pasta.
Right. It's amazing great. With the pasta, because my wife once had her appendix out when we were in Italy.
Mm. Oh.
An emergency. And then so she had to spend some time in an Italian hospital. And when you're in an Italian hospital, they literally wheel a cart into your room, and you get out of the hospital bed and you sit at the table and you eat the pasta.
It's so civilized.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it, right? It's a whole, like, the pasta is this beautiful sort of conduit,
right? Right.
To, like,
it is.
All of life's pleasures.
Right, right.
That's the way it's, you know, right. It was like, this baby is 6 months old. She hasn't lived yet until she has the pasta.
Of course.
She got pasta.
Oh. So now you have Zoella in your life. And you're here in L.A., you're working as an actress, you're killing it as an actress, and your husband is successfully cooking for all of L.A., and then what happens?
Well, we received a diagnosis. Actually, it happened even before Zoella came into our lives.
Oh, before Zoella.
Yeah. He was diagnosed quite by chance with a rare soft tissue cancer. And we had the blessing of catching it early because the prognosis for the kind of cancer he has is not particularly great, right? And, you know, someone asked me this recently and I said, oh, well, they said, how did you find it? You know, how did you... And I said, well, we actually took a yoga class together. It feels like I'm going to go on a... But it is. It's like one of this. It's a circle.
Right, right.
We took a yoga class together, and he overdid it because, you know, he was being macho in a class full of women. So anyway, he tore his meniscus in the yoga class. Painful. But it led us to the doctor.
Mm.
And it was from that x-ray and sort of the imaging around it that they saw something else.
Mm.
So it was we were very lucky.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's one of the other things that I try to share in the book is this sense of these moments that are incredibly painful. Also, there's these slivers of grace that are always around us.
Mm.
Because having caught the cancer so early, we were able to have what then becomes this 10-year journey, right? And during that journey, during a moment of remission, Zoella comes into our life because, of course, we wanted to be parents. We'd always wanted to be parents. And I got to be a caregiver, which is challenging, life expanding, heart expanding, but it also deepened our marriage in a whole new way. And I found parts of myself that I didn't know I had, and I had my standing in the rain opportunity.
Yeah,
for
because
him.
We talked about that earlier, but how you were able to stand up and give back to him.
Yeah.
But what did you discover about yourself that you didn't know was in there?
I guess I realized over the course of those years that I can hold as much pain as I can hold joy.
Mm.
Right? And there's not a lot that scares me. Well, a lot scares me.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm scared a lot.
Yeah.
You know, we all are,
yeah.
Right? But what I learned is that I don't let the fear stop me from leaning in to what is available to me in the moment, other than the fear,
yeah.
Right? And it becomes a mindset, a way of living. Because having had 10 years as a caregiver, right, through the ups and downs of critical illness, oftentimes not knowing what was going to come next, what was around the corner, how would this surgery work out, what was this treatment going to work, this clinical trial, you're constantly in this up and down, right? So... the other thing that I really had to do was really stay centered and close to myself so that I could show up for him as a partner, as a wife, show up for my daughter, as a mother, and also show up for myself. I mean, one of the things about caregiving is it's really easy to sort of abdicate all of your energy, you know, to this big life event, this thing that's happening, right?
You talk about the fact that you can even have resentment toward
Absolutely.
The person you love the most.
Absolutely. And one of the things we got really clear about was we had to be bone to the bone honest with each other about everything, right? Which were the times when I had to say, this is too much, I need a break. When he would say, I need you to back off for a minute, I got to just have this time for myself, you know, and we had to really kind of navigate some rough terrain as a couple.
Yeah.
But in that, we were in agreement that we were going to show up for each other no matter what, no matter how, whenever, and to the best of our ability. And that becomes a way of engaging with life and in your primary relationships, right?
You talk about this very articulately in this TEDx talk that you've done. It's called What 40 Steps Taught Me About Love and Grief. People can find it online. But what is the message or messages that you would want people to take from that?
At the end of the day, we are all going to face our trials, our tribulations, our joys. The ability to stay present and connected and lean into the love is the thing that is our salvation.
Yeah.
The only, and I can say that because I've lived it firsthand, right? I've lived with the pain of watching someone I love most in his dying hour and years before that, critically ill, unsure. And the thing that pulled us through was this understanding that our love for each other and the desire to have each other be as fulfilled in any moment, which is going to sound sort of strange, right? How can you, in the midst of a critical illness, be fulfilled? But if you start looking for it, you'll find it. And sometimes that fulfillment is a phone call with a friend. Sometimes that fulfillment is a walk by the beach. Sometimes that fulfillment is a kiss from your kid, right? It's this simple living. And in a lot of ways, Sato taught me that, because that is a part of like the Italian way, particularly the Sicilian way also. Like the sort of simplest, like sort of like, we don't have much, but we got this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you described this beautiful moment. And I think, I don't know if it was one of the first times you went to Sicily, where he takes you and he closes your eyes and he makes you smell something. And you describe the just the sensations of that. And we so rarely sort of have moments like that.
And in a way, illness slows everything down, right? The way in which your life is moving at its clip pace, you're doing this, you're having a great life, and then boom, something changes.
Yeah.
And then that when you have to engage life in a new way, and the thing that becomes that that sort of salvation, that peace, that grace, is a willingness to be open to life's simple pleasures. And having been married to a chef, that was sort of, forgive the food metaphor, baked into our daily, you know, sort of way of being, but it got even richer. And so the thing that I tell people, or the thing that I hope that people take away from the TED Talk, is that sense of really in each moment being as connected to the person that you're with as is possible.
You have the wisdom now to look back and reflect and to see those moments when you're in it. And for those people who are in it now, can you see those moments as you're living them? Or is it just upon reflection later, oh, those were beautiful moments?
I had moments of glimpses of it. But for the most part, it was sort of I was chugging ahead, trying to sort of handle the tasks at hand. I was blessed with people in my life who said, take a moment, take a breath. I had people in my life who said, I don't know if you can see what you're doing, but this is really wonderful. And I think, and what you're, what I see, this, the love I see growing between you with your family, it's incredible. So I wasn't in the moment, I think, fully aware. What I was aware of was the need to write down everything that I was going through. And that writing became a salvation. Some of it makes its way into the book, right? But that way of pouring myself out onto the page was a way for me to stay present with what was happening.
I see.
So that I didn't just kind of spin out, because you can. You can get caught up in the crisis moment of things and the fatigue.
Yeah.
It was very fatiguing.
Yeah.
Long-term illness is very fatiguing. So to people who are going through it, really what I say is to the people around the caregiver, lean in, ask them what they need, offer help consistently.
Yeah. And actually do it, right?
And actually do
don't
it.
Don't say, I can, anything actually you need, let me know. Because that's not really useful,
no,
is it?
No, the best, I'll tell you, there was we had a lawn that was completely overgrown.
Yeah.
And I had a neighbor like, I'm going to mow that for you.
Huge.
Do you know, like, seeming like the most simple thing in the world, it lifted my spirits to know, in one, to know I was cared for, thought of, two, that someone's willing to go out of their way to help, and thirdly, I now had something pretty to look at.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You know what I mean? It was
right.
Like, you also gave me, like, a beautiful aesthetic, you
right,
know?
Right,
like,
right.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah, so.
When did you feel accepted by his family?
I think, you know, I think I felt, you know, the it almost immediately, because I think that they saw how much I loved their son, right?
Huge.
But then what began to happen over time was then we began to know each other. And a kind of, and even, and I write about this after Sato's passing, a deepening of that relationship, particularly with my mother-in-law, right? That closeness, our friendship. And so that was an unexpected thing. I did not know that I would be as close to her as I am to my own mom, you know, and dad in a way. You know, I never could have imagined that, you know, those many years ago when we first met.
Yeah. Zoella has grown up here.
Yeah.
But maintains, obviously, this great connection to her Italian family. And I wonder, how do they feel about the fact that she's over here? Don't they want to? I mean, that's the strange irony, isn't it? This family who rejected you, I suspect, they want you to live in Sicily.
I mean, listen, my mother-in-law, we talk once a week. She says to me, so have you gotten the ticket? When are you coming? You know, like she wants to know, like, you know, when what is this happening?
Right.
And when we're there, she wants us to stay for longer.
Yeah.
You know, I always tell Zoella, you know, when she's like sort of, I'm like, you know, I'm going to enroll you in Sicilian school. She's like, wait, what? You know, she likes her life in L.A., but
right.
she also loves going there, not only because she gets to be with her grandma and a town of cousins and second cousins. And but she gets a kind of freedom.
Yeah.
Right. And that I can't give her here in a big American city. You know, she's not going to just going to like wander down the Sunset Boulevard, you
right,
know, and
right.
like find her way.
She could. But,
she could.
Right.
But, you know, Child Protective Services would have to come, you know, but there,
right.
you know, there is another way of living. And I think that is what Sato wanted me to love about Sicily was this sort of way in which community folds in on itself and helps each other, the way that the natural world, I mean, the natural beauty of the island, you've spent time in Italy, although I know not Sicily, it's just gorgeous, right? It's very healing in and of itself.
There's something about the Italian sun that's just different.
It's different. Yeah? It's completely different. And the Sicilian sun is like, you know, it's intense in the day, but there's this gorgeous moment at the end of the twilight when you're like, oh my God, I understand why people conquered this island for thousands of years. They knew what they were doing.
Right,
they were like, we got to get some of this.
Right,
you know? But yeah, no, Zoella loves being there and we love our time there each summer.
This book is a Reese's Book Club selection, Reese Witherspoon. You can't tell us whether it's been optioned to be a film or whatever. I'm just going to assume it is. And to ask you, if it is someday made into a film, you're an actress. Could you play yourself and look across at someone playing Sato and be that actress?
No, I could not.
Yeah.
I could not. My psyche, there's nothing in my bones that could make that happen. Because, one, it lives in my imagination and in my heart in such a specific way. And it's in the book. And I lived it.
I lived it.
And I could never relive it again in that way. Not for, you know, art's sake, right?
And
to a degree, I relived it when I wrote the book. So, you know, I think that would be very trippy.
Yeah.
Plus, who would play my husband?
Right.
I mean, I'm sure there's some, you know, wonderfully handsome men, but that, you know, I would
imagine that it would be difficult for you to see it portrayed in any way.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, one of the things, you know, that I... You know, even in writing the book, I thought, how do I, you know, at the beginning of the book, you know, the readers know Sato's no longer with us, right? You know that from the beginning of the book. And my job as the writer of this was to sort of make him come to life fully on the page, so that I wanted, when people finish that book, to love him as much as I love him, right? And he is so magical for me, you know, and I think we all feel that way about people we've loved and loved, because they hold some place deep in our hearts. And I know, you know, should someone ever play him on screen, right, they will do their version of him, and it will have nods to who he is, right, and elements of who he is, and anchored in his energy, right? But it'll be someone different.
Right. Yeah. I would imagine, as an actress, you've seen so, and maybe you've played roles that are based on a real person.
Yeah.
And we've, you know, I've interviewed people who said, oh, you know, I'm trying to get the essence of the person and try to portray the essence with, you know, with my interpretation. When you are that person now who is seeing yourself or your late husband portrayed the essence, that can't be enough, right?
I don't, you know what? You are fast forwarding to a time.
Right.
When I can't
right.
even begin to, I mean, I can't even wrap my mind around it, right?
Yeah.
And even I was thinking for Zoella, you know, should that ever happen? Like, how is that, what's that going to be like for her?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So it's, you know, the fact that, and I think he would really love that we're having this conversation right now.
Yeah,
he'd be like, he's probably casting somewhere in the heavens. Like, yeah, he's got to look like this, you know.
Right.
But I think it's just, you know, that's, I think, the beautiful thing about the power of storytelling anchored in true experiences is that we all, and I'm hearing this from people who are reading the book now, it's making them reflect differently on the people in their lives, right? And sort of saying, let me not take mom, dad, brother, sister, colleague, friend, whomever, for granted, right?
Yeah.
We hold everyone a little more in a different, a precious place in our hearts.
Right.
Right?
You have, the book is from scratch, and you included recipes.
I did.
At the end of the book.
Yeah.
And these are his recipes?
They're a combination.
Or the family's recipes?
Both. Sada's recipes that I found, some from my mother-in-law, some that, you know, I researched and tweaked a little bit.
So when you're making them, are you seeing his hands?
I am seeing his hands.
Yeah.
You know what? I think he still would laugh at the fact that I have like the worst knife skills in the world. Like, I spent 20 years with a chef and I'm like,
right.
He used to laugh. He's like, you can't even, like, you know, peel a pear. You know, because he did it so artfully and, you know, sort of like all this one unified piece.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know. But yes, when I cook, he's very much with me.
Mm. Is that why it was so important for you to include the recipes?
Very much so. And also the fact that food, I think for all of us, we all have some recollection of a particular dish that either grandma or someone, a friend, an aunt, a mom made, a dad, right? And it lives in our imagination. And so you can imagine, for me, after he passed, my kitchen fell silent. I mean, literally silent.
Mm.
And finding my way back into that space, and then trying to feed myself, which we all know, and my daughter, in grief is a hard thing to do. You are fatigued in a way that you can never have imagined, right?
Mm-hmm.
So food and reawakening my palate, our sense of pleasure, all of that was a big effort. And I really had to ask for his help. You know, I had to say, Sada, I, you know, what do I do?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I kind of knew, but I kind of didn't know.
Right, right.
Because he'd done all the cooking.
Right,
you
right,
know,
right.
For the most part.
Yeah.
You know, and I also had Zoella, who was looking at me, who had 7 gorgeous years of her life with a chef. And I remember I made a meal one day, Frank, and she looked down, she looked up, she looked down, she looked up, and she said, Mommy, you had 20 years with him, and this is what you learned?
Oh!
So it was like, yes, it was that.
Yeah,
it was
the dagger.
It was but it was also like, it was kind of a wake-up for me also, because I was like, I did have 20 years with him.
Mm.
I do know a lot.
Yeah.
And he's still with us, and he needs to be with us here, right?
Yeah,
because when you're married to a chef, you know, three times a day, we would sit down and share a kind of intimacy together. So just eating a meal with Zoella and I as a, as two people was hard. You know, we felt that absence, and we wanted to bring life back in. So when I sat down to write the book, having been married to a chef, having it set in Sicily, food was going to be there in an essential way. Plus, my mother-in-law, it's her love language. When I'm there with her, mangia, mangia, ma che fai, dai, mangia.
And has it gotten better? You know, people will read this book and say, oh my God, this amazing love affair. And then he dies. And you and your daughter go on. You have, yes, his family, but you don't have him anymore. Are you okay?
I am. And I have him in a different way. And I think that that was something I discovered in the writing of the book. Meaning, I actually thought when I started to write the book that I was going to be writing a book about, you know, sort of pulling my way through loss, which in part it definitely is. What I didn't know that I would discover in the course of writing is that Sato is with me every moment. He's in my heart. It is, he's a part of my DNA, my understanding of the world. That will never go away. And so the knowing of his love, the experience of his love, stays with me. I did not know that the first day, week, year, 2 years after he was gone. It was something that has taken me years, and over seven years now, that, and I think it's a process, and I think many people who are widowed or who are grieving learn a new relationship with the person who's passed. You don't stop thinking of them. You don't even stop talking to them. And it's not hocus pocus. It's not weird. It's just, you know, I'm like, Sato, what the hell do I do right now? You know, what do I ask? I stay open. And so to that, in that sense, I think that is the promise within this book and about grief, is that there can come a moment in which, wherein you feel completely, you've integrated the loss, you still feel connected to the love, and you find a way, as they say, that the light comes in through the cracks. I'll never not miss him. Never. Never. It's impossible. It's like changing my eyes to green. It's just not going to happen. I'm never not going to miss him. But I have found a way to have him, keep him close. Some of it is, I'll just make a meal that we like. Sometimes it's talking to people who knew him. Sometimes it's reading letters he wrote. You know, writing this book, in a way, was my way of keeping him close.
But I would think that people would say, gosh, that must be so painful to go back to relive not just the painful moments, but even the beautiful moments must be... hard.
You know, here's the thing I've learned about life. Sometimes side by side is our pain and our joy.
Yeah.
And to think that it's a one or the other is, it doesn't set us up sometimes to be present with what is. Because, so my love for him is equal to my grief and my pain. And yet I found a way for them to live side by side. And sometimes I can belly laugh at something he said. And sometimes I will deeply, you know, cry or feel sad. What happens over time, in what I have found, and I've talked to other people who are 20 years out, 10 years out, you know, and I've looked to guides, really, you know, people in the public life, but also people in my private life who have walked the path of losing someone that they love deeply, and say, what do they do? How do they find their way through? And the thing that that people keep saying is that over time, those deep, heart-wrenching moments come fewer and fewer. They're there. And when they come like a tidal wave. But where they don't come as close together as they did initially. And I am also more prepared when they do come. I've got, like, you know, basically like the, you know, the bat phone or the presidential phone to, you know, my close group of people to say, hey, I'm having a moment.
who'll get you through it.
Who'll get me through it.
Yeah.
And then I go on, and I think that's kind of what life is.
Yeah.
And we can't fool ourselves and think it's not.
I want to end with a scene you write about, and I think it might be one of the first scenes of the book, where you are in Sicily, and you have his ashes. And you go and essentially illegally take his ashes to the countryside, or maybe
possibly
someone,
illegally.
Possibly illegally.
Italian government. Right.
If you're listening, Italian government, possibly may have happened. And when you go back to that place now, what do you experience?
I go there every summer, that exact same spot, because it is a reminder of the great love. It's a reminder that I am still here, and what do I want to do with this wild and precious life that I have? And I think that's something that I'm borrowing those words directly from the poet Mary Oliver, but I'm also borrowing the spirit of it from Sado. And one of the things that he said to me was, I want you to have your life. Right? That was one of the final things he said to me. And so I'm not going to take that lightly. And I do know that I have a finite amount of time on this planet. We all do.
Yeah.
I can't shy away from that. I can't turn away from it. And what would I like to do with it? So when I'm standing there, one, I'm overcome with the beauty of the place. It's an olive orchard. There's the Mediterranean there. It's the height of summer, the smells, the sights. It's just your senses are on overload.
Yeah.
And then I also get to stand in a place that was so meaningful to someone I loved so deeply. And I can say, I am still here, and you are right here with me. What are we going to do?
That's beautiful. Well, Tembi, thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. It's been such an immense pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you. That was Tembi Locke from 2019. We'll look forward to speaking with her again when that Netflix series comes out that they're shooting right now in Italy. Thanks for listening again this week as we celebrate 5 years of Frank Buckley interviews. Until next time, I'll see you on TV.